Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. My name is Corey Fleck and I am your host for this weekend show. Also your host throughout the week. Be sure to check out our website, kereport.com, for daily market interviews and a lot of exclusive company updates and introductions. It's been a busy week again, and you know what? I am excited for this show. I am kicking off this show with Peter Buchvart, Chief Investment Officer at Bleakley Advisory Group, also editor of The Book Report. That's a website that I go to every day, and I have periodically posted some of the excerpts of what Peter has been writing and sharing with his subscribers. Peter, I want to start off with the inflation discussion. You had something that came out earlier this week that I found very interesting. It was highlighting former New York Fed President Bill Dudley, his opinion piece on Bloomberg, where he gave five reasons to be worried about the risk of an unpleasant surprise in inflation. Look, we have inflation expectations rising, but we're not seeing a whole lot of the underlying inflation data show that inflation right now, at least. Where do you stand on the inflation narrative, the inflation argument, and the lack of strong inflation that we're seeing right now?
Well, it depends on where you're looking in with respect to this inflation discussion. If you look at home prices in the U.S., they're rising nearly 10%. So that's pretty aggressive home price inflation. But because U.S. CPI and PCE measure rents instead of home prices, that is not really captured in the CPI number. Now, I do think at some point it will, and that you continue to see those aggressive home price increases. You'll see a sharp rise in rent increases, particularly when the moratoriums on evictions and rent payments go away within the next couple months. That combined with more transfer payments from the government to individuals, you'll start to see rents go up. If you look at the good side, and I talk about rents because it's 30% of core CPI, so it's a big swing factor on where the headline inflation number goes. Now, on the good side, we're seeing year-over-year price increases on goods, core goods, ex food and energy, that's rising at the quickest pace since April 2012. So you're approaching a nine-year high at the pace at which core goods prices are rising. And that is in response to the major supply disruptions that we continue to see, a spike in transportation costs where everything that is produced ends up on a ship, a truck, a plane, and we're seeing prices rise pretty aggressively there. And also the change in consumer spending behavior where in 2020 people spent a lot of money on goods, depleted inventories because factories were closed for a few months. And then hopefully this summer we're going to get a shift to services as people start to go for dinner more and travel and go to hotels and fly and this and that on the services side that then possibly takes away some of the pressure on the good side but then can create inflation on the services side. So I think in the aggregate the pressures are building. We certainly are seeing that in terms of the expectations of investors with the rise in inflation expectations in the TIPS market, which is at multi-year highs. I mean, you have to go back to, I think, 2013 to see the last time you've seen at least the five-year inflation break-even in the U.S. This high at around 233. And back then, oil prices were around $100 versus 50, 58 today. So, you know, just imagine if you did get higher oil prices, and maybe this also implies market expectations that inflation is potentially a broader risk than it was even then.
So I agree that just looking at the data is a bit misleading when it comes to what individuals are dealing with inflation-wise, but we do need to consider, too, that it seems like over the last decade, a little bit more than a decade now, is that the whole inflation narrative when it comes to the data has a bit been muddied or turned on its head, really, when you balance that out with, let's say, market inflation. And that continues to happen as markets just continue to move higher. How do you balance those two out?
Well, right now the market's moving higher because of just massive momentum, the hopes for another $2 trillion in government spending, the belief that the vaccine is going to save the world's economy in the next 3 to 6 months as it gets further rolled out, which I get. I think there's a lot to be optimistic for in the services side, particularly this summer, because I think getting the vaccine is going to be life-changing. Now, it'll take time depending on where in the world you live, but at least in the U.S., there's the possibility that by the summer, there is some form of herd immunity, and I think that it's important to have some optimism. The issue, though, is I think that, again, it's going to come with higher inflation. It's going to come with higher long-term interest rates. We have not only a central bank that is rooting for higher inflation, but one that is also saying that they are looking past any rise in inflation, at least over the next couple months, because they'll refer to it as transitory. Now, there will be base effects that help inflation because the comparisons are obviously very easy compared to March, April of last year. But once you get into the second half, and I believe the inflation statistics are not going to be so transitory and that they will be somewhat longer lasting than at least the Fed thinks, I think that the long end of the bond market is going to tighten for them. And that's going to translate into a potential issue for equity markets that have very high valuations and predicated on very low rates.
So let's address the long end of the market, because even as the Fed has been really just standing still, the long end continues to rise. As you and I are recording this, the 10-year is over 1.16%. I know this is still historically low, but fact of the matter is the trend has been higher. When is that going to matter for markets, and when's that going to matter for the Fed?
I mean, I think the Fed right now doesn't mind it. They don't mind to see some steepening of the curve. I think for the rest of the markets, particularly the stock market, it's a great question of when it will matter. And that's really just, it's the magic question. And I think that you're really not going to know until you see it. But the trajectory of rates is clear. It's been pretty steady. I mean, we just, the end of August, we're actually middle of August. We've just about doubled since then. Now, again, as you said, rates are still historically low, but we have to understand that a couple of things. We have massive amounts of debt, so small changes in interest rates has a pronounced effect. We have historically high duration levels in bonds. Corporate bond duration level is averaging almost 8.5 years, which is well above where it's been. So changes in longer-term interest rates has profound impacts on the pricing of longer-term bonds, which, if it's sustained, can then raise the cost of capital and impact valuations as well. So it's something that we need to keep a very close eye on here.
So, Peter, I think it was, let's say, 5 years ago that we heard some of the pundits saying that we're in an everything bubble when it comes to the equity markets. These days, I think that's even more relevant as we see a wide range of sectors continue to move higher, strongly higher, on the back of nice volume, strong breadth. Across the board, we're seeing a lot of sectors break out. Are we at that stage now where we do have an everything bubble?
Well, we do, but you could have said that a few years ago as well. And then the reason why we do is because the world's bond markets, particularly negative yielding bonds, which is the epitome of a bubble, it's the biggest bubble in the history of financial markets. So all these other assets are priced off the cost of money. So yeah, it is an everything bubble, just almost by definition, if the cost of credit is so low and the bond market that prices it is in such a bubble. But bubbles can continue, and the question is when it doesn't matter, and I don't know. But I do know that what will make it matter will be the direction of inflation and longer-term rates, because when inflation is low, central bankers feel like they have a license to do whatever they want. When inflation all of a sudden is not so low, well, then that license, the market potentially can take away that license. So we have in motion right now the possibility of seeing the pin that will eventually pop the bubble. But again, we don't know when it will. But inflation numbers are ticking higher, inflation expectations are moving higher, commodity prices are moving sharply higher. The CRB raw industrials index is at the highest level since 2014. So it's not an opinion on certain parts of inflation. At least on the good side, it's fact that there's inflation. Yeah, I'm looking at a chart right now. The Royal Industrial Index is at the highest level since May 2014. That was a while ago. So it's here, but it's just a matter of how widespread it gets and what the impact is going to be on longer-term interest rates.
Okay, so it really is all about rates right now and inflation and eventually how the Fed will react to it. Can I just get your quick comment, too, on a story that we were covering a couple weeks ago on all these short squeezes and how the retail investor was able to push around some of these hedge funds and stocks like GameStop? They even arguably came into silver, but it was such a bigger market that it didn't have the same impact on silver. What was your takeaway from the short squeeze narrative that took hold really at the tail end of January?
I feel like I've seen this and read about these things many times. There's a history of manias in markets, whether it's tulips, whether it's the South Sea Company, whether it's iOmega. We've had a history of bubbles, a history of short squeezes, and this was nothing new. It just took on a little bit different form. The avenue of communication was just a bit different, but the underlying human nature part of it is still the same. It's people that want to get rich quick, and nothing more. And it really came back to earth like every other mania like that. This is, I guess, you can call this the Reddit mania. But it's a movie that I've seen, and as I said, I've read about many times in history. And for those that want to learn more about these sort of things, they should read Charles Kindleberger's book, Manias, Panics, and Crashes.
Okay. Hey, good advice there, Peter. Let's also now move on to commodities, because you made the reference that commodities are also moving higher, except for, let's say, precious metals. We're seeing base metals continue to break out, energy commodities moving higher, green commodities moving higher. Where are you focused when it comes to individual commodity sectors?
Well, the interesting thing is we're seeing all commodities, pretty much all commodities, so it's a broad-based rally. We're seeing it in the grains, corn, wheat, and soybeans, notwithstanding a little pullback here in corn the last couple of days. We're seeing it in industrial metals, particularly copper. Certainly seeing it in natural gas, which is around $3. We're seeing it in oil, which is approaching $60 and WTI. So we've obviously seen it in gold and silver and the precious metals, even though they've been seeing some consolidation since the August spike. So it is broad-based, and that's reflected in the CRB index, which has had a nice move here. And I do think that we're on the cusp of further gains. I mean, we've had years of underinvestment. We've had everyone focused on technology and not really investing in this space. You don't hear anything about a copper SPAC or an oil and gas SPAC because no one cares. And I think that that's going to lead to further supply-demand imbalances that are going to lead to higher commodity prices and higher inflationary pressures as a result.
Well, and that does tie into the inflationary pressures as well. What about this general weakness, about 7 months of weakness for the precious metals, especially gold, just continuing this downtrend? Might have put in a arguably double bottom here in the last couple of weeks, but overall, gold has faded a fair bit from those highs back in August.
I think that we've seen a consolidation since that time period. We definitely saw a big spike where gold went from about 1,400 up to 2,000, and silver went from like 17 to almost 30. And I do think that with the dollar somewhat stabilizing here, even though I think it's temporary, it's still stabilizing, and real rates that are sort of, you know, pretty much at the lows but have stopped going down, I think was reason to see this consolidation. The question then is, when does the consolidation stop and the run start again? And I'm not sure the answer to that, but I do think if you see another leg down in the dollar, which I expect, and if these inflation numbers tick higher further, you'll get another leg down in real rates. And that will be the next sort of juice for another run in gold and silver.
All right. Yeah, just waiting for that next driver. Let me ask you about this government stimulus bill too, Peter, because it seems like every government stimulus bill out of the U.S. does get delayed, but they have been passing in eventual time frame. What do you think about this current government stimulus bill as it seems to be getting pushed through in terms of what sectors or how it impacts the broad averages?
It'll happen, and most of that money is going to get spent. So almost $2 trillion on top of the $900 billion that was passed at the end of December. Extraordinary amounts of money. But a lot of it is just filling holes at the state and local government level, filling holes and allowing people to pay their back rent as moratorium and eviction rules expire soon, paying for the vaccine. So I don't look at this as stimulus. It's more just more fiscal spending and filling holes. And at the end of the day, we're not going to have anything to show for it. It's not like we're going to have new bridges and new bouts of infrastructure that follow. We're just going to have a lot of debt, large budget deficits, and greater inflationary expectations where inflation could eat away whatever check is issued to individuals and families.
So regarding infrastructure, do you see an infrastructure bill being passed maybe sometime this year?
Well, that follows, and I know some people would love to see it, but I think at least the Democrats are using up a lot of financial capital on this bill that I don't know what the appetite is going to be left after to spend another, call it, $1 trillion.
That's the question, isn't it? But that's on a lot of people's minds, especially for commodity investors. Peter, leave us with just a broad comment on how you're viewing these markets and what you think a good strategy is for trying to understand these markets and the key drivers here mostly focused on, as we've been talking about, inflation and rates.
Well, that to me clearly is the key driver. I mean, I think where the stock market's going to go this year will be more dependent on what the P/E ratio will end up being. I think it's the direction of earnings, the direction of the economy will be up this year. But what should be the right multiple? And I think the determining factor of that will be where rates end up. If rates are still stuck here at 1.115, then people can substantiate a multiple where we are now, even though I think that's still very rich, and I don't necessarily agree with that. But if all of a sudden the 10-year yield goes from 1.5, 1.75, 2, and the back half of this year the Fed starts to taper or talks about tapering, because they're being forced to because of the inflation numbers, you're going to see some rather sharp multiple compression that I don't think this market is prepared for.
All right, Peter, it's great having you on the show, buddy. Again, you can check out Peter's daily thoughts over at his website, The Book Report. I will post a link in the weekend show posting. It's great having you on the show, Peter. I really value your opinion, and I really thank you for taking some time out of your weekend. I hope you have a great weekend.
Thanks, Corey. You too.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. In this segment, I am chatting with Mark Chandler. He is managing partner over at Bannockburn Global Forex. Also writes the Mark to Market blog. Now, Mark, you and I chat every week on Friday, usually looking ahead to the next week's key catalysts and also reviewing what happened in the past week, following up on some of those news events and key catalysts. However, you know what? This week was a little bit slow, and next week there isn't a whole lot to discuss. So one thing that you and I were talking about really deals with a theme heading into this year. Everyone's talking about inflation. They continue to talk about inflation, but some other rumors that I'm hearing, and even hearing you bring this up, makes it a little bit more real for me. That is the potential of a commodity super cycle. We might be at the early stage of this commodity super cycle, as we are seeing commodities almost across the board continue to rally. We've seen some weakness in the precious metals, but you look at base metals, you look at energy metals, you look at oil, everything else does seem to be moving strongly higher. Mark, give us a little rundown of where you think, or the potential of this commodity super cycle.
Yes, I think that there's two components of it. One is, like you say, right now you've got, look at oil prices in the U.S., the March crude is finished last week pretty close to $60 a barrel, highest. I mean, remember last April we were at negative. So the idea is that a combination of some supply discussions like OPEC cutting oil, or the Saudis announcing that they were unilaterally going to cut 1 million barrels of oil this month and next month. You've got some other like issues like that with supply. The U.S. inventories now are near the five-year average. But the real part of it, I think, for a lot of people is going to come from demand. You know, between this end of December package the U.S. had of $900 billion and this other one that they're working on, we're talking about 10% of GDP. And a lot of the idea is that I think two other branches come from that. One is strong economy. That's going to fuel demand for goods and services. And those goods prices, those raw materials will be driven up as demand jumps. But the other part of it is the sort of the financial side of it. So you get this what's happening. How do we fund this huge stimulus? More debt. And people, I think, at some point say, well, we don't want debt. We want hard assets. We want real assets. And the other issue sort of stems from this for the commodities. And I think that this is so we've got stock markets near record highs, not only in the U.S., but you know, the Japanese market made it's at its highest level since 1991. And so I think people are seeing rising equity markets without really improving profits. And there's about $16 trillion of negative yielding bonds in the world. And so people, I think, are looking for other assets. I think that's part of the appeal, they think, to the crypto space. But here's what I think happens is that we want them to diversify our assets, our investments, away from just paper assets. And I think that draws people to commodities. Right now, investable commodity market is about $200 billion or so. And I think it was Goldman at a conference I was at was saying that it could go up to $5 trillion, they think, in the coming years as commodities, just like early in my career, emerging markets were not really part of people's equity portfolios. Now it's almost a permanent part of a diversified portfolio. And the idea is that going forward, given the debasement of paper assets or the abundance of paper assets, if you will, that people are going to want to buy claims on real assets, commodities.
So that's a big change from what we've seen in markets, especially over this last bull market cycle. Over a decade now, we've seen, it seems like, individuals, fund managers, everybody in a way largely ignore commodities and simply put their money into these paper assets. You all see this changing right now, but what is spurring this change? Is it simply because markets are so high and commodities broadly haven't had their time to shine?
I think that's part of it, but I think there's another element here. When I was back in the, this must have been early 90s, we were having the S&L crisis, or a banking crisis problem in the U.S., and I remember having lunch with this famous economist at the time, Albert Wojanowar, and he was asking me, I was very early in my career, of course, and he was asking me about what like investment ideas and stuff, and I told him how much I liked gold. And he said, oh, interesting idea. He said, what kind of gold were you buying? And I said, well, I was looking at this one gold company. And he said to me, you're young. So he said, he'll forgive me. But all I was talking about doing really, he said, was buying a paper claim on a gold company. I wasn't really talking about buying gold. And what this has to do with our discussion now is that up until now, people, for the most part, these portfolios, large pools of capital, have only had access to paper claims on commodities. But I think there's an effort now to like securitize commodities so that imagine rather than just having a paper claim on a silo full of corn, you'll have a digital, it won't be a paper asset, it'll be a digital claim. You can say, here's my corn. You own that or you own a share of that. And you've got, say, a blockchain or something similar to that to keep like the chain of custody, if you will. So what we're talking about is the securitization of commodities that might not have been available previous to this like round of financial innovation.
So it's really just bringing commodities up to what has happened for stocks, for companies, for the broader financial market then, hey? Offering some different opportunities of how to invest in these assets?
Exactly. Making these accessible. So imagine, it's sort of like, what's the popular, gold. You have the you have gold futures contract these days. You also have gold ETFs. And out of those ETFs, you got some derivatives of like 2 times gold or 3 times gold, whatever they do. And I think that commodities now, I think that's an evolution that we're moving. We're not there today or tomorrow, even though there might be some individual cases of this, that the big move toward commodities is going to take a while to like digitize, if you will, securitize commodities to make them available and the increased accessibility to them. So like build it and they will come.
So, Mark, you're a currency guy, and when we talk about commodities, especially a commodity super cycle, we do typically see different types of currencies, more the commodity country currencies, run higher. But you can look at different currencies, and I've heard a lot of arguments that kind of muddy that water. As a currency guy, how do you see a commodity super cycle playing out in the currency markets?
Yeah, that's interesting, huh? Because, you know, you have this, you've got this rally going on in real commodities. And you say, well, what paper asset can I buy that also benefits from it? And I think that it's two ways. One is, remember thinking that it's like a bit of a fad. And so there's many things that are going to affect currencies. And in this, as people are talking about commodity super cycle, and you got a rising CRB index, I'd say the Australian dollar has been quite interesting. It's been a lot stronger than people had thought. I'd say that in this past week, it is up alone about 1%, while the other dollar block currencies like the Canadian dollar and the Kiwi are up about half as much. The other element there is the Norwegian krone, which has typically also done well. Not just rising oil prices, but as a proxy for rising commodities in general. But I think that the key would be that there's a lot of other things that influence currencies. But in the current mode, the current fashion, I think that the Aussie and Norway look pretty interesting.
Okay, a couple currencies to keep an eye on. Now, what about all this fiscal stimulus that is coming from governments and how it plays its role? Because, again, this argument has been muddied by the fact that fiscal stimulus over the last decade, let's say, has landed in financial markets, not so much in commodities. Is it finally trickling into commodities in your eyes?
Well, I think that's the hope. I think that's back to the promise, if you will, is that the... that's the thing about the Australian dollar and Norway as well. It's not only that they get lifted by commodities, but they get lifted by what should be the key to the demand for commodities, and that's a booming economy. Somewhere around middle of the year or so in the U.S., we might be close to herd immunity. Europe might be a little bit behind. Assuming like the base case is that economies begin coming back in a strong way, middle of the year, Q3, that should lift commodities as well as these high beta currencies. It's interesting too, though, that it can't make up for everything. So, for example, one of the weakest currencies this year is a huge commodity producer, Brazil. So we want to be careful that rising commodities can help some countries, but it's not necessarily a cure-all.
Absolutely. But okay, one thing to consider here that you said is that this whole commodity super cycle is predicated on an economic restart, right?
Well, I think so, but it also might be predicated on, imagine if there's no restart. Imagine that we find that for one reason or another, the virus has mutated, our vaccines don't last for that long, and it ends up to take us several more months or quarters to get out of this. And central banks continue to provide easy money, and federal governments keep spending money. And I wonder if this portfolio diversification story for commodities could withstand that. That is to say that maybe the basement of paper money is one of the things encouraging the move to commodities. So you've got the two drivers, really, right? The debasement of paper and the possibility of a real surge in growth.
Interesting. So then do you see any individual commodities outperforming? Right now, it seems like the EV metals and clean energies are outperforming, but in all fairness, everything has run higher.
Yeah, it's what I'm looking at, and I guess like we try to do this in other parts of our lives. Like we try to find something that hits more than like one sort of like you can like some kind of force multiplier where several themes or ideas can come together. And for me, a company that I know as when I say it, many listeners are going to say it's already rallied a lot. But the company that sort of for me fits into this is a company called Energy Fuels. Stock symbol in the U.S. is a UUUU. And what's interesting to me about the company, and I do own it, and I'd like to buy more if I could, is what I like about it is first, there's one uranium mine in the U.S. This is it. And not, so that sounds like, this does not sound very ESG friendly, but here's a thing that I found that the company is doing. It is finding some of its uranium, recycling it. So mining new uranium. How else do they get uranium? Recycling. And as a byproduct, and it's not, and for sure I'm more of a currency person than a meteorologist or a metallurgist, but I'm under the impression that as they get this uranium, one of the byproducts, a lot of where the uranium is this other metal, I'm going to mispronounce it, vanadium.
Vanadium.
Vanadium, yep. Vanadium, which is used for these batteries, so it retains energy very well. And in the U.S., we are very dependent on China, Malaysia for rare earths. And this company is also beginning to process some rare earths. So to me, it hits on several different of these points that we're talking about. The commodity cycle, that should be good for the EV and uranium. Green recycling, the rare earths, economic nationalism, bringing that stuff back here. And so I like the idea, and I still do, even though the stock has, I think, and I don't want to overstate this, but I think that it has outperformed Bitcoin in the past month.
All right, Mark, final comment before we leave this interview. Do you believe that we're in a commodity super cycle right now?
I think that we could be on the foothills of one. But I'm not convinced that it's necessarily going to boost inflation. When you think about the things that we buy as consumers in high-income countries, we buy primarily services, not so commodity-intensive. Secondly, the things that we do buy of commodities tend to be not so much labor-intensive, pots and pans. My sense is that you can have higher commodity prices and not necessarily have higher inflation. This rally in oil prices, many people in the U.S., U.S. policymakers tend to see higher oil prices as a tax on consumption, not as sign of inflation. It's really a sign you can get an economic a headwind on the economy.
Interesting. All right, Mark, we're going to wrap it up here. Good comments and very interesting discussion. I'm sure we'll be talking about it as we move through this year, but if we are at the start of a commodity super cycle, look out, this can last a long time and it can benefit a lot of investments in commodities broadly. Mark, again, thank you for your time this weekend. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back here to wrap up the weekend edition of the KE Report. I'm going to switch focus a little bit to the battery metals or electric vehicle metal plays that have garnered a lot of attention recently. And I know there are a lot of investors that want to try to take advantage of this uptrend. But quite frankly, when you break down some of the metals that are involved with this EV play, like nickel, copper, and lithium, they're a little bit less understood than some of the other, let's call them more mainstream metals, like gold, silver. Copper's tied in there, but again, nickel, lithium, this is new to a lot of investors. I am chatting with Steve Todoruk. He's an investment executive and geologist over at Sprott Global Resource Investments. Now, again, just to clarify, because I do bring Steve on about every 3 weeks, is that we cannot discuss individual companies due to regulations, due to regulatory issues, but you can, Steve has offered to help you analyze any companies that you have in your portfolio, ones that you are interested in, by emailing him. I will post his email address in the weekend show posting. If you can't find that email address, you can always email me directly, fleck@kereport.com. So Steve, let's start off in a broad sense, a broad look at the EV plays here, nickel, copper, lithium. What are some of your just initial comments when you hear from some of your clients that they want to get exposure? What do you tell them?
Hi, Corey. Thanks for having me. Part of the problem is that in the nickel space, you know, say specifically, is there's not a lot of significant nickel deposits out there. That transcends down into the junior mining space where, you know, with a lack of exploration in that sector, we haven't had a lot of significant discoveries in recent history. So juniors tend to go out and you know, grab, you know, acquire, get a hold of old properties. You might call them retreads. They've been worked and drilled in the past in previous decades, going back a long time, and they weren't good enough to be mined at that time. So they sat on the shelf, and now all of a sudden nickel's hot, you know, copper and lithium battery metal plays are, you know, our hot space to be in. And we're seeing a lot of these projects, you know, being reworked again. So it's kind of like, you know, I always take the stance there, buyer beware. If it didn't make it before, why is it going to make it this time? So just, you know, buyer beware, know what you're getting into.
Steve, what about when you're looking broadly, different jurisdictions or different assets, what does, in your eyes, make an attractive investment in these sectors, considering how new or how newly on the radar they are for investors?
As usual, I like to see grade. I want to see, you know, good attributes to a project. You know, the infrastructure is good. Country risk is, you know, reasonable, hopefully really good. You know, and then the types of nickel mineralization, if we're looking at nickel, is it nickel sulfide, which is the preferred end product that you want to end up with for the most part. Fortunately, we've got, you know, no nickel deposits or mine. You know, we've got a number of places in Canada, Thompson, Manitoba, Voisey Bay, around Sudbury in Ontario. So that's good if companies are exploring there. Down in Minnesota, the eastern U.S., you've got some. And Australia is quite well known for their nickel deposits. So that's the good news, is that, you know, at least if a junior is going to be, you know, working a project, you know, chances are pretty good it's going to be in a good country. So I like that.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, in terms of advancing projects, we all know mining does take a while, but what, in your eyes, is broad time frames for these type of projects? These are typically larger projects, so in my eyes, they do take longer to bring online. What do you look for in terms of developments and certain stages of projects?
Well, again, I've got, as we've talked on previous shows, I've got a pretty specific and exact niche. I like the new discoveries, so I want to see juniors out there that are, you know, doing basic exploration, starting with soil sampling, prospecting, geophysics, and then, you know, identifying targets and anomalies, and then they bring in the drill, and I'm hoping for that discovery drill hole. So we are getting some of that. You know, I'd probably say we're seeing a lot more of that raw early stage exploration happening in Western Australia specifically. And we've got, you know, maybe up to 5 nickel discoveries. Also Brazil, there's a nice junior that's got a pretty good looking nickel project down there. It's another country that's okay. I'm not a big fan of mining in Brazil, but it's certainly not the worst country out there. A lot of the Canadian and Eastern U.S. properties, like I referred to a few minutes ago, they've been around a long time and they've been worked and they're all, you know, they're all cashed up. The market's happy to finance them, and that's good. But I'm hoping that on one of those properties that have been worked before with fresh new drilling, that we'll find something, you know, brand new, bigger, and good grade than what's been known there previously.
So as I mentioned on the onset, copper is a bit better known than these other metals, especially in terms of just the number of companies that are in the sector. Copper definitely has more companies than lithium companies, than nickel companies. However, recently, I think all three of the sectors have experienced a bit of a surge in terms of new companies. How important is it to understand the geology, though, of nickel assets and lithium assets in terms of end products? Because from my understanding, and I'm not overly well-versed in either of those sectors, but there it's a lot different production scenario and a lot different geology than what you're looking at in simply, say, a gold or a copper mine.
Yeah, but just do one comment there in regards to copper. Copper's extremely common used metal. We need copper every day we get up for all facets of life, you know, starting with infrastructure building. You don't need nickel and lithium, you know, nearly as much as those. We've got the big electric vehicle push, so that may, you know, light a fire, or if we could just see prolonged steady nickel prices, I'd be happy. Nickel tends to be, you know, quite volatile, you know, kind somewhat like zinc. Both those metals are very fickle, if you want.
So then in terms of different minerals or different makeups of minerals, when it comes to nickel and lithium, what do you see? What do you pay attention to?
Again, I'm definitely not an expert on lithium. What I sense, or the little I know there, is that the end product, like, there's different ways to process it. And some processes are more challenging. They're going to need a lot of metallurgy, which usually involves or means more expensive to produce that end product. You've got to, in this kind of a bull market in those sectors, the investor ideally knows what the end product's going to be and how the company's, you know, going to get to that end goal. And the companies are still trying to figure that out. So how's an investor supposed to figure it out? Yeah, I guess what I'd say to keep it simple, and I've got clients obviously phoning me up lately saying, what about lithium exposures? Even I say, I'm not an expert. Why don't we just keep it simple so we can both sleep good at night? Just buy the big lithium miners. Let their experts, they know what they're doing, type of thing, rather than bringing the risk of, you know, trying to shift through the juniors to figure out which of the juniors have good projects. Just keep it simple and go for the big miners.
Yeah, absolutely. Protects you on that downside risk, but can still offer you that torque to the underlying commodity price there. Now, Steve, as I mentioned, there are a lot of new companies that have come into this sector. Everyone always talks about management. You need to pay attention to who the management is. Unfortunately, when we do see these sort of smaller sectors run, we see a lot of management teams that don't really care what metal they're in. They're just following the trend. What do you look for in a management team in these sectors that are a bit newer?
I try to make sure that the manager of the company isn't a group that's known to do exactly what you just said. They're chasing the flavor of the month on the hopes of, you know, raising money in a bull market and, you know, nice job stability type of thing. But as an investor, that doesn't excite me at all. So try and avoid that if you can.
Absolutely. When it comes to drill programs, then what do you like to see in certain drill programs when it comes to trying to make the discoveries in these renewed sectors?
Don't go drilling a known deposit. You know, they're called market holes, director holes, twinning holes. You don't need to do that. It's rare that needs to be done. So if you've got a tiny or a small deposit, hopefully there's been enough work done, or the current company's done some, say, metallurgical work on that known deposit, just so you know that, hey, your property's prospective, the best place to look for a new deposit, right near known one. So if there's a known small deposit, hopefully management has done some due diligence work to figure out, hey, this property, you know, it's justified to try some new ideas or some new lines of thinking on it. Maybe something has improved, whether that's metallurgy on the deposit or new geophysics or some kind of new technology. Go apply that on other targets on the property. You know, I'm all for that. That's how you make discoveries type of thing. So keep an eye out for that if you can.
Yeah, definitely be aware of market holes or twinning of holes. Those can all be an issue. Final comments then, Steve. As a geologist, I realize not focused necessarily in these metals. Do you think that this trend, this battery or EV metal trend, is here to stay?
I think it is. You know, we all want to see a cleaner environment. So I drive a big yellow Hummer. It's 2007. It's a gas guzzler. I wish I could convert it to electric. I don't think that's possible. I might have to buy one of the new electric Hummers, but I think it's here to stay. It makes a lot of sense, and that this could be something in the nickel space that we've never seen before. You know, usually nickel is used for reinforcing steel and things like that. So this is a brand new application that looks and feels pretty good. So I'm all for getting good exposure to the sector, but just be careful. Know what you're buying. Do your homework.
Absolutely. Hey, Steve, it's great having you on the show. Thank you very much for your insights in these flavor of the month type sectors. But in all fairness, these sectors that do look like they have some longevity to them because of this move towards electrification and greener energy initiatives around the world that is picking up steam. Again, if you have any questions on individual stocks, you can email Steve directly. That email will be in the weekend show posting, or send me the email fleck@kereport.com, and I will forward that on to Steve. Everybody, please keep the emails coming. I love hearing from you all week, and be sure to check back throughout the week and even recap a lot of those company interviews and sector-specific interviews that I conduct every day throughout the week. Everyone, Steve, you too. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend. Thank you all for joining us.
Okay, thanks, Corey.